Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Oshman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 102, Studying Happiness. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And today, in our continuing series, celebrating our 100th episode and looking at some of the big ideas that have emerged in the first 2 years and that may become significant or even more significant as we move forward into the next 2 years, we're excited to welcome today Tal Ben-Shachar. He is an author, lecturer, researcher on the subject of positive psychology, which is something that has come up quite a few times on our show from Erwin Kula, Evan Mafik, and others have raised the possibility that the purpose of Judaism going forward is or ought to be helping human beings flourish or helping them be happy. When Tal Ben-Shachar was a lecturer at Harvard, he taught two of the largest classes in the history of Harvard University. One was called Positive Psychology, and the other, The Psychology of Leadership. Tal also is the author of a number of best-selling books on the subject of positive psychology and happiness. His first book was called Happier, Learn the Secrets to Daily Joy and Lasting Fulfillment. His other books include Even Happier, Being Happy, Choose the Life You Want, and The Joy of Leadership, How Positive Psychology Can Maximize Your Impact and Make You Happier in a Challenging World. His books have been translated into over 25 languages. He is a highly sought-after speaker, consultant, and workshop leader. And we are very excited to welcome him today to Judaism Unbound. Tal Ben-Shachar, welcome. It's so great to have you.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Lex. It's great to be here.
So the subject of positive psychology has come up a few times on our podcast, but we haven't done a really deep dive into it. And so I was wondering if we might start by your giving us a sense of just what is the basic idea of what positive psychology is all about, and then perhaps some of the most important findings.
Happily. So positive psychology is essentially the science of happiness. Specifically, you know, today, if you go into to a therapist's office or a couple of counselors' office, or if a consultant comes to your company, the first question that they will ask you will be, what's wrong? You know, what's not working in your life, in your relationship, in your organization? What positive psychology does is it takes a different approach. It begins by asking what is working. What is working in your life, in your relationship, in your organization, beginning with that. In other words, what positive psychology does is it focuses on what works, starting with that and then building on that in order to deal with the things that are not working. Now, what does positive psychology study? It studies happiness first and foremost. It studies love and relationship. It focuses on topics such as strength, meaning and purpose, and so on. Over the last few years, the field has grown a great deal. And the reason why it has grown is there's been some great results in companies introducing it or in individuals introducing it to their lives, in schools introducing this. So it's the science of happiness and comes in as a complement to traditional approaches to psychology, not as a substitute, but as a complement to the traditional approaches that mostly focus on the things that are not working.
And is the idea, sort of comparing it to, let's say, the world of self-help, is the idea, the distinction being that it's really grounded in science and experimentation as opposed to, I don't know, what might you say the self-help world is grounded in?
Positive psychology is, as I see it, is emphatically about self-help. However, it's different from the approach that the self-help movement has conventionally taken, in that the self-help movement has mostly relied on charisma. It has relied on individuals' personal opinions and ideas, whereas positive psychology focuses on research. That's where it starts. That's where it ends. You know, so if you have an intervention program, it starts with findings, with interventions that have been discovered through science. Then the intervention is then evaluated through scientific means. It starts and it ends with science, and that is what distinguishes it from the self-help movement.
Before we get into the details of what some of the most interesting and important findings of positive psychology have been, could you give us a little bit of a flavor of how the experiments are run? You know, how does science get applied to this kind of area?
Sure. So the approach that psychologists, that scientists take is the multi-method approach, meaning we use questionnaires to assess people's levels of well-being. At the same time, we also measure people's brains to see how they're doing. You know, today we know what a happier brain looks like. We know what a compassionate brain looks like. We also know what a depressed brain looks like. So today, more and more scientists are using physiological measures, again, whether of the brain or whether things like a galvanic skin response or heart rate variability. The general approach would be you have an experimental group, you have a control group, you give the experimental group the particular intervention, you know, do this or that, or write about this or that, and then you see whether it has the impact or what kind of impact it has on their well-being as they're doing it right after, as well as a month or a year later. Because, of course, what we're more interested in are what interventions have long-term impact. What interventions make a difference in terms of your behavior today as well as 6 months from now?
Because we're coming at this from our, you know, Judaism Unbound angle and from the realm of what we might think of as religion, I know that many of the ideas of positive psychology have been applied in realms of religion, and that there's people, not just in Judaism, but in a number of religious traditions that rely on positive psychology for a lot of what they do. And I was wondering if you could comment a little bit as to, like, what is the overlap between positive psychology and religion? And it might be apparent on some level, it might be straightforward that if one's goal is to become happier, that religion's goal might also to help make people happier. But maybe that isn't so self-evident for some. I'd love to hear what you're familiar with in terms of how religious practitioners use some of the findings in positive psychology.
One thing that we find in research, in psychological research, is that religious people, on average, are happier. Now, this doesn't mean you can't have an atheist who's extremely happy and a person who's religious who's depressed. Of course, you have both. But on average, it seems that religion contributes to happiness. Now, the interesting question here for scientists is why? What is it about religion that contributes to well-being? And the answers are actually quite apparent and quite straightforward. So some of the research in positive psychology shows the importance of expressing gratitude. So people who express gratitude on a regular basis, for example, writing down or visualizing things for which they're grateful for once a day, they're happier, more optimistic, more likely to achieve their goals. In other words, more successful. They're also physically healthier. So it actually strengthens our immune system to express gratitude. And finally, they're more generous. They're kinder towards other people. Now, what is religion to a great extent about? It's about expressing gratitude. You know, a Jew waking up in the morning, the first word that he or she would say would be modeh, not modeh ani. You know, the first word is modeh, is, you know, I'm expressing gratitude. And this, apparently, now the science shows, contributes a great deal to personal happiness. Another determinant of happiness is time we spend with other people, with people we care about and who care about us, with a community. Well, inherent in religion is a community. There is also Shabbat. More and more research is showing how important it is to take time off. But the real problem in today's world, with the rising levels of depression and anxiety, is actually not stress, but it's the lack of recovery. People don't take time off. Well, in Judaism, you take time off. And by the way, not just for Shabbat, because when you're davening, when you're praying, that's also a form of time off. In fact, it's perhaps the best form of recovery, of time off, because it's a form of meditation. You know, prayer is meditation, especially if you do it with kavana, with intention. There's a lot of research showing how beneficial meditation is to our well-being, psychological and physical. So these are some of the benefits of religion. And of course, perhaps the greatest benefit is that religion provides us with a sense of meaning and purpose in life. Religion provides us a reason to wake up in the morning. Many people today don't have that. So that's another contributor to happiness.
So before we go on and explore this question of religion, I'd love to back up and ask you if you could lay out, from your perspective, what are the most essential findings of positive psychology in terms of what are the actions or thoughts or behaviors that are most likely to lead a person to a happier life?
Yeah, so some of the things that contribute to happiness, I wouldn't just situate in the field of positive psychology, but I would say there are general findings from the field of psychology. Some are more particular to positive psychology, others more general. So here are some. Exercise, physical exercise, contributes a lot to a person's psychological well-being. In fact, there is more and more research coming out almost by the day showing the impact of regular physical exercise. Regular physical exercise has the same effect on our psychological well-being as our most powerful psychiatric medication. In fact, it works in the same way. So if you go for a run, you're releasing norepinephrine, serotonin, dopamine. These are the feel-good chemicals in the brain. Regular exercise, as little as 30 minutes three times a week, can have the same effect as our most powerful psychiatric medication. In addition, relationships, the number one predictor of happiness is quality time we spend with people we care about and who care about us. In the countries that are the happiest countries in the world, even though they're not the wealthiest countries in the world, and sometimes there are countries that have their fair share of problems, like Colombia and like Israel, in the happiest countries in the world, there is an emphasis on relationships, whether it's family relationships or friendships. For example, you know that in Denmark, 93% of the population are members of social clubs. Could be your church or something. But they're active members of social clubs. You know, these all contribute to happiness, so relationships, and especially today. Today there is more and more loneliness. Loneliness leads to depression in our modern world because even the friends are virtual. And unfortunately, 1,000 friends on Facebook are no substitute for that one BFF.
So I want to ask you one more question before we go into the Judaism stuff. Just like, why is the goal happiness? Like, what is it that... How do you define the goal of, you know, what we're trying to achieve with human life? Because a lot of times, you know, when people ask us, you know, what are we trying to do with Judaism? You know, I try to, you know, answer, I'm trying to make it be something that makes people's lives better. You know, and they say, well, what does make people's lives better mean? And that's where, you know, that's where I think the interest in positive psychology comes. Well, like, it would start with their being happy and their feeling that their lives are good, I guess. But then are there other elements to what success looks like, such as making a contribution to the world at large? Or, you know, how do we sort of lay out the potential goals of what a good life is? And then, you know, is it that positive psychology or other fields kind of study all of them, or that positive psychology is really focused on this one, but there are a number of others that you think about? Or how do you sort of situate this work in terms of the goal of a good life?
Yeah. So first of all, it's important to understand that whether we consciously think about it or not, whether we admit it or not, we are pursuing happiness. You know, we can be pursuing something in the form of pleasure or meaning, or we look to feel good, or to, you know, to avoid pain. But we are ultimately looking to feel better, to experience more happiness. Now, the question is, and this is the second issue, the second question is, how do we define happiness? You see, if we just define happiness as pleasure or as a good feeling, then we face a very serious problem, because life is not just about good feelings. Moreover, it's not possible to experience good feelings all the time. However, if we see happiness as more than just a good feeling, if we see happiness as including a sense of purpose and a sense of meaning in life, if we see happiness as also being related to our interpersonal relationships, if we see happiness in addition to that also being about our emotional well-being, then we see happiness as a more holistic concept. And then we're better able to understand what it is that our life is about. Our life is not just about pleasure, but our life is certainly about finding a sense of meaning and purpose. Our life is certainly about joy and simcha. Our life is certainly also about cultivating relationships. And these are, of course, all interconnected. Because if I have healthy relationships, I'm experiencing meaning in them. If I experience joy and simcha, then my relationships are actually better and I'm more likely to find a sense of meaning and purpose. Happiness is a multifaceted concept, and it's important to understand it as such.
I just keep on flashing to, 6 years old in kindergarten or whatever, wherever I was first given the famous sentence, money can't buy happiness. And I'm struck that I think that that's true, that money can't buy happiness, but I'm also struck by that if you lack money enough to a great enough degree, you may almost by definition lack happiness. And so I guess what I'm wondering, and I think this is, I've heard this critique expressed before. How does positive psychology address issues that may be external factors to an individual themselves? There may be, and there are, millions of people around the world for whom just the basics of poverty mean that happiness as defined may be difficult to achieve. Certainly they could maximize their happiness within a particular frame, but how does positive psychology engage with the ways in which individuals may not be able, through meditation or through prayer or through these individualized kinds of actions or behaviors, remedy circumstances that are due to, greater systemic kinds of factors?
Yeah, so, the pursuit of happiness does not absolve us as individuals or as a society from trying to better the external conditions of our life. So happiness is not affected by external circumstances, except for at the extremes. So while additional money, if I have my basic needs met, will not make a difference or that much of a difference to my happiness, if I don't have my basic needs met, then of course my happiness is affected. The same with basic safety needs. External circumstances, whether I live in California or New York or Arkansas, that doesn't make that much of a difference to people's happiness. But if people are living in a war zone or in a place where their basic rights are not respected, then yes, that is going to affect happiness. Now, having said that, one can make better or worse use of money. So it turns out that, for example, if you spend your money, if you have discretionary income, if you spend your money on experiences rather than things, you would be on average happier. So if you get $10,000 and with that you can either go on a long vacation with your family and friends or buy or upgrade your car, then you'd be better off having the experience, the former rather than the latter, if you're thinking about happiness, not just for the short term, that is for the long term impact. Which is counterintuitive to many people because they think, well, I'll have the car 3 years from now. I'll be able to enjoy it where a vacation is over in 2 weeks. Well, it turns out that the vacation is not, or the benefits of the vacation are not over in 2 weeks because they build relationships, vacations, and they create memories. And all these things are a lot more important than having a faster, better, newer car. So experiences over things. The second good use of money is actually giving. People who give, who help others, get a great deal from that act, which of course goes back to religion. Tzedakah, charity. It's not just the receiver who gets; it's also the giver. Which I teach a lot of workshops in around the world. I give a lot of lectures. And the word that I most often teach people and Jews and Gentiles alike around the world is the word for give in Hebrew, which comes from the root natan. And the word natan, I always write it in English on the board. And I say, can you see anything peculiar with that word? N-A-T-A-N. And, you know, everyone immediately says, oh, yeah, it's symmetrical or it's a palindrome. You can read it the same way both ways. And I say to them that I don't think it's a coincidence that it's a palindrome, because when you give, you also receive. You get just as much back. And today we have the science to back up this ancient wisdom. In addition to that, it is very important to help people expand their worldview, because one of the things that has really been emphasized in the United States historically is individualism. And that's great and that's important. You know, ena nili mili, you know, first yourself. But then it's important to take the next step that Hillel talked about. If I'm only for myself, then who am I? You need to go outwards and expand. And one of the things that positive psychology researchers think about a lot is, how do you expand this perspective from just the self to include others?
You know, as you were describing earlier, what are some of the things that religion tends to be good at in terms of the kinds of things that correlate with happiness, such as community and time for recovery and meditation and that kind of thing? I was thinking, well, what are the things that religion seems to be not so good at, or perhaps even bad at, that sort of anti-correlate with positive psychology's findings? And, you know, I think that one of the ones that at least strikes me in terms of what we're just talking about now is that, at least in the Jewish community, right, that many of the institutions that were built in the 20th century, the Jewish institutions, were built to sort of help other Jews, because other Jews needed that help at that low level of Maslow's hierarchy. And now, as that is less the case, and as you say, that there are still many people out there who may need help at that level, but they may not be Jewish, that our institutions are not necessarily oriented that way. And that gives, for example, young people a sense that our institutions are bad, right? You know, that our institutions are overly tribal. And so the question, I guess, is, as we change in our own needs and in our own economic and other senses of well-being, you know, how do we make that transfer to saying that now we should direct our attentions to, as you say, tikkun olam, the betterment of the world? And that's not a neglecting of our own. That's actually a recognition that, A, our own people are maybe less in that state of need than they used to be, and B, that it actually, even just for selfish reasons, right, that it also will contribute to our own happiness if we do more of that kind of work.
Yeah, correct. So I think what this is about, it's about expanding or modifying our sense of self. And if I can go a bit philosophical on you for a minute, there's a lot of talk in moral philosophy distinguishing between selfishness and selflessness, or egoism and altruism. And I think these are false dichotomies. And here is the reason. You see, because when I'm pursuing happiness, I'm being selfish in that respect. But now you look at the dictionary definition of selfishness, or you look at a thesaurus, and the words that are equated with selfishness are words such as evil and bad and so on. On the other hand, if I'm helping others, then conventional wisdom would say, well, I'm being selfless. And you look at synonyms to the words of selflessness: it's good, it's moral, ethical, generous, benevolent, and so on. So there's a real distinction and a very strong schism between being selfish and being selfless, between being an egoist and an altruist. However, if you think about in the context of giving, if it's so, and we know it's so from research as well as from personal experiences, we know that giving is receiving. Then when I'm giving, I'm helping someone else. But at the same time, I'm also helping myself. So none of the words as they're used today are adequate to explain what I'm doing, what I'm experiencing, what I'm being. Am I being selfless? No, because I'm helping myself. Am I being selfish? Well, I'm certainly not being immoral and evil. I'm helping other people. So it's time to bring together these two concepts. And instead of selfish versus selfless, I suggest a synthesis between being selfish and being selfless, between egoism and altruism. And it's in this manner that we need to think about our life. How can I be self-full? How can I expand the self? Yes, to think about my own happiness and, not or, they're not in opposition, and at the same time to think about others. The more I contribute to my own happiness, the more I contribute to the world. And that's why Tikkun Olam is not just a philosophical mandate, it's also a psychological tip.
So I'm really intrigued. First off, you've given a lot of wonderful midrashes from your palindrome on the word Natan, which is a palindrome in both English letters and in Hebrew, to just your sprucing of Hebrew phrases, Tikkun Olam here. And I mean, it's not what I knew this conversation was going to go towards. And because of that, I'm like really curious now to like delve deep into some of the Jewish conceptions of happiness, because there's 1.5 million words for happiness or approximate equivalences with happiness in Hebrew. And I guess because you're a native Hebrew speaker, I'm really curious to hear what you think of them. And so just to name some of them, simcha is of course one that we hear all the time in reference to, you know, happy occasions. That's a simcha. But there's also words like osher and rina and sason and all of these. If you were to think about Jewish conceptions of happiness, or in this case, Hebrew language conceptions of happiness, which of them map closest to how you would like folks to think about happiness in a way that's not just pleasure, like you talked about, but is a broader, more holistic sense of what happiness might mean?
So the word that I use when I speak about happiness in Hebrew, I use the word osher. And osher is comes from the same root as the word le'asher, which is to acknowledge, to approve. And what that essentially means is, do I live a life of which I approve? Do I live a life of which I acknowledge its virtue, its value? In other words, is it a good life? So it's not just a mindless, happy-go-lucky kind of life where I just, you know, pursue the next immediate pleasure. It is a life of meaning and purpose. It is a life where I think deeply about my role here and my purpose here.
I was watching a video where you were talking at sort of the beginning. You were talking about the notion of the permission to be human, and you know, which you analogize to the law of gravity. You know, that there's no point in trying to say whether or not you believe in the law of gravity. The law of gravity, you know, gravity is gravity, and so if you don't adjust your life to take note of the law of gravity, you're not going to do very well. And it seems that clearly, in positive psychology, there's this effort to understand what human nature is and to accept it, and then say, how do we work with the materials that we've been given? And I guess I'm curious, like, how you think about that in relationship to religion in two ways, and perhaps to Judaism in particular. I guess there's a question of number one, is that a theme as you see it in Judaism and in religion, this idea that we are accepting people as the sort of flawed creations that they are, and then trying to give them a roadmap to live the best life in the best way that they possibly can? You know, or do you think that religion is sometimes really, you know, wrong in terms of over-idealizing and making it as though people need to be doing things that probably realistically they can't do? You know, and then the other side of that is a question of religion seems to be pretty good at a lot of this stuff. And I'm wondering if you think that happened because there are just some people who are involved in the creation of these, you know, religious systems who kind of got it on a deep level, right? That they somehow were intuiting a lot of the things that science is now finding, or is it more that they kind of got lucky and some of the stuff they put out there is right and a lot of it's wrong, just like is probably the case in the self-help world?
A word that I use a lot throughout my lectures that is the closest word that I know of to God is nature. And in fact, in Judaism, at least some interpreters see them as synonymous or is very close. So the word El, one of the meanings of the word El is force. And it's force in the sense of gravitational force or other forces that are part of nature. To attain happiness, we need to do two things when it comes to nature. One is study and understand nature. And two, it's adhering to nature. And that is very similar to some people's notion of a God. You know, first understand the words of God, and second, live in accordance with them. Only I don't think it is necessary to go through an intermediary text, but we can study God directly. And the second thing, what Jews have done historically to a great extent, not only, but to a great extent, they have studied nature. They've observed nature, and they came up with prescriptions that are based on nature. So whether you call it God or you call it nature, for me, they're interchangeable. But again, this is just one approach to Judaism, you know, seeing nature as a capital N nature. And the reason why I think Judaism has gotten it right so often is because Jews throughout history have made a point of studying nature, not going against nature.
As this episode is released, we're in January, and we're not so far off from the month of the year in Judaism that is most associated with happiness, which is Adar. And there's a few things that strike me about it. One is that, so every few years, I think it's like 7 out of 19, when you add a month to the year so that the calendar still works, so that we don't have Passover happening in the summertime or whatever, as the solar and lunar calendars get out of whack. The month you add is Adar, so you get twice as much of this extra happy month. And I'm thinking about that from a few angles. One of them is that, I'll be totally honest, there's this famous saying, the one who enters Adar increases their happiness, which is really nice, theoretically. But I've had moments during that month of the year where I don't feel that happy, to be totally frank. But I feel like there's a pressure to be happy. And I bring that up as like a microcosm of a broader question, which is there a danger in feeling this immense pressure to be happy as we seek that happiness? And on those lines, is there anything, I mean, Dan hinted at this before, but is there anything in religion or maybe even in Judaism in particular that you think actually isn't so great for our happiness? Are there practices, maybe it's related to this Adar piece I'm bringing up, maybe it's not, but is there anything that's part of our Jewish tradition that you actually have found through research might not be something that we want to hold on to as strongly in the future?
The idea of having to be happy is detrimental to happiness. There's a lot of research showing that actually pursuing happiness directly makes us less happy. So if my objective is, you know, I wake up in the morning and it's Adar or Elul, it doesn't matter. If I wake up in the morning and say to myself, I'm going to be happy or I'm going to pursue happiness, that is actually likely to detract from my happiness. In fact, people who directly pursue happiness are more likely to be lonely, and they're more likely to ultimately be depressed. That's a problem, though, because on the one hand, we're saying, well, if I pursue happiness directly, then I'll be less happy. But on the other hand, we also know that happiness is good for us, that people who are happier are healthier, that people who are happier are actually more generous toward other people, that people who are happy are more successful. So for all, you know, for every reason, we want to be happier. But on the other hand, we're told, don't pursue happiness. So what do we do here? How do we resolve this seeming paradox or contradiction? And the answer to this question lies in the indirect pursuit of happiness. So it's possible to break up happiness into its components. For example, happiness is about spiritual well-being. It's about finding a sense of meaning and purpose. You know, happiness is about physical well-being. Happiness is about intellectual well-being. Happiness is about interpersonal, relational well-being. Happiness is also about emotional well-being. Now, I can pursue each one of these components of happiness separately. And through them arrive at happiness. So I'm pursuing happiness indirectly if I'm pursuing and looking for more meaning in what I do. I'm indirectly pursuing happiness if I exercise on a regular basis and work on my physical well-being. I'm pursuing happiness indirectly if I'm cultivating my relationships, spending quality time with my loved ones. I'm also cultivating happiness if I'm engaging in text and studying and learning, that is intellectual well-being. So indirectly pursuing happiness does lead to happiness. And that's how I resolve the paradox. So just saying, okay, be happy now, or tarbe besimcha, you know, be happier now, you know, that's not helpful. However, if I say, okay, you know, find more things that are meaningful and engage in those, or spend more time with your loved ones, or exercise more, then I'm indirectly pursuing happiness, and I'm actually becoming happier. You know, it's a little bit like the analogy that I use is like sunlight. If I look at the sunlight directly, I don't enjoy it. In fact, it will hurt me. It's too bright. However, I can look at the sunlight indirectly, meaning I can look at the sunlight after it's broken into some of its constituents through the rain, through the prism. And I observe and look at the rainbow, and the rainbow is beautiful and I enjoy it. That's how I'm indirectly looking at sunlight. In the same way, I can indirectly pursue happiness and then enjoy its fruits.
I'm interested in pursuing a little bit further this question of, I guess you could think of it in a way as the bundling problem, that when you look at religion, and again, looking specifically at Judaism, you know, you can see, look, the extreme version might be, let's say, in the ultra-Orthodox community, where you say, well, we have a lot of close-knit community, a lot of meditation, you know, a lot of gratitude expression, you know, a lot of these pieces, maybe a little bit not enough exercise, but but they come along with a bundle of other requirements that are, you know, not really able to be used by many people, right? A role for women that obviously excludes many women and many men who would, you know, not like to live in a community in which women had that status. You know, certainly a community that's not accepting of other gender identities, and you know, and all sorts of elements where you say, well, if is my choice that I have to give up on a variety of things, probably many of which also my happiness is dependent upon, in order to receive the bundle of goods that brings that happiness. And I'm wondering if we could kind of do a little bit of, or how you might sort of suggest that we do some of that excavation or archaeology or something that says, let's, or, you know, is it even possible with a system like Judaism that's grown up as a system over a long period of time, and to say, well, now I can examine it and I can say, here are the elements that seem to work really well with the findings of modern science, and here are the elements that would seem to be almost the opposite of those findings, and how do I tease them apart, and how do I kind of think about creating them in a new way? And it, clearly there's also a question of, and I guess I'm curious what the science says about this, that let's say somebody is not a believer. So on the one hand, expressing gratitude is powerful, and you said it's powerful even if you're writing a letter to someone who's no longer alive. But what if you're essentially writing that letter to someone who you don't believe in, you know, who you don't believe in at all? You know, I mean, are there limits to this? You know, are there ways to say, look, I mean, we really do need a reimagination here, because even if you accepted that Judaism is pretty good at achieving some of these goals, it's just not going to be possible for so many people.
Yeah, so I think the important work here is the work of unbundling, or not seeing it all as a package deal. So there's a great deal of wisdom in Judaism, and yet in Judaism, certainly as it has been interpreted by people over the years, there are many mistakes that today we see through science. The thing is not to throw out religion or all of religion, and not to throw out all of modern science, but to take the thing through a critical eye and a discerning mind to identify what is working in religion and what is and what is not. Now, you know, personally, when I see God as nature, if the Torah explains a part of nature, and if it explains it better than other writings, then I'll take that. if the latest research from the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology explains a truth about human nature that isn't in the Torah or that even is opposed to something that's written in the Torah, I'll take that. When you talk about the Torah, you talk about Torah Chaim. You know, you talk about alive. I think one of the harmful elements to Judaism is the idea that you shouldn't add or subtract anything from it. The important thing is to see the our religion as constantly evolving, as having the foundation of a happy life, of a good life, and yet at the same time being open to growth, to development, to new learning based on scientific evidence.
As we go towards our conclusion, I'm wondering if you were in a position, based on the work that you do and the thinking that you've done, to say, here's what I would like to see a process of Jewish reimagination taking serious note of, being seriously concerned about. What are some of the things that you would really want to put out there and say, you know, these are elements that really ought to be prominent in a reimagined approach to Jewish living?
You know, I think it would be great to put Jewish thinking to the test of science. You know, Judaism has been put up to the test of philosophy, of rigorous thinking, but it hasn't been put to the test of biology or psychology, the social sciences. And I think it should, and I think it will emerge even stronger and more compelling, because Judaism has so much to give. I mean, it has given me, is giving me so much. It has so much to give, and unfortunately, if it remains as a dogma, it will become less and less relevant, except for the very few who are comfortable living a dogmatic life. Because there are things that absolutely have to evolve, and the first thing in improving is admitting that things are changing, that not everything is valid or even good. You know, some of the things that have to evolve include the relationship of Judaism to women. You know, the fact that men every morning are mandated to say Shelo Asani Isha, thanking God for not making me a woman, that is problematic. You know, I wouldn't want my daughter to feel less of a human being than a man or any woman in the world to feel that. So Judaism has to evolve, and leaders who are interested in promoting Judaism, in making Judaism relevant to more people, have to see it as an evolving living system rather than as a dogmatic dying system.
Thank you so much, Tavin Shachar, for joining us for this conversation. It's been a great one.
Thank you very much, Lex. Thank you, Dan, for doing such an important work in unbounding and unbundling Judaism.
Thanks again to all of you out there for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we want to close it out in the same way we always do, by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can check out our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can always hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last plug we like to make is that you can always support us with a financial donation, either on a one-time basis or a monthly recurring gift. And you can do either of those at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.